Thank you. I am Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. Out in my country, they say, what comes after old Chuck C.? And the answer is Tuesday. Everybody down here, including the fella that just introduced me, tells me that I got to sit down on time. But I haven't even got up yet. Now he wants me to confine it just to one subject. No A, B, and C, he says. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank the committee for allowing Mr. C and I to share this weekend with you. Some of the people I love best in the world are right here tonight. And I've had an awfully good time up until now. I guarantee nothing from now on. I can tell you why Mrs. C. told you this morning. You all know that Chuck talks a great deal. She said that, didn't she? And I'm going to tell you why. A little over 33 and a half years ago, I ran out of everything. Time, health, sanity, money, people, and everything else. And it became necessary for me to find Alcoholics Anonymous in order that I might not drink for the few days I had left, so that I might rub out as much of the record as I could before I died. And I didn't know how to find y'all. My keen alcoholic mind told me that you wouldn't be in the phone book. You were anonymous, weren't you? They don't anonymous in the phone book. So knowing that you weren't in the phone book, I never looked. And that is the story of my life right there. I knew so much that wasn't true, I couldn't learn anything that was. So I had to call people and ask them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a hold of a chap's name, telephone number, from a doctor in Beverly Hills. And I called him up. And we talked a little while. He was a picture man. And he said, have you had a drink today? And I said, no. Well, he says, don't take one. He says, I'm working nights right now, and I can't take you to meeting tonight. But I might not be working tomorrow night, so call me again tomorrow. And maybe I can take you to meeting tomorrow. So I called him tomorrow, and we talked a little while. He says, you had a drink today? And I said, no. He says, don't take one. I'm still working. He says, call me again tomorrow. And I called him tomorrow. Then we talked a little bit. And I says, I know you're still working. And he said, yeah. Well, I says, you don't have to tell him. You don't have to take me to a meeting. Tell me where there's a meeting I can go to. And I'll go myself. And he told me. And it wasn't too far from my house. And I determined to go. And I felt all right about it until it was almost time to go. And then I got a little bit worried. I thought it might not be good for my reputation. to be seen with people like you. Now, you don't know how funny this is, really. Because I'd spent more time in the Beverly Hills jail the 10 years prior to this than the jailer had spent. And yet I get concerned about being seen with y'all. So I disguised myself a little. And the time came and I sallied forth. Now this meeting was in the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall at the corner of Wilshire and Santa Monica in Beverly Hills. Some of you would identify it as the building that Wilson's Suede Shop is in the front. The Veterans Foreign Wars Hall was in the back of it. And it was on the ground floor. And I went to the meeting, and I walked up there to the door, and I looked in. And there might have been 35 or 40 people standing in the middle of that room. You mind you, this is over 33 years ago. And there weren't many people in the West in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. So, I looked y'all over, and again, my keen alcoholic mind started to work. And it told me that I'd been given the wrong information, that this was the wrong night. These were the veterans and their wives, and they were there for a party. Because, you see, you didn't look like me, and you weren't dressed like me, and you most certainly weren't talking like me, because every one of you was talking and nobody listening, and it was all happy talk. So you couldn't be alcoholics. You were the veterans and the wives, and you were there for a party. And I was going to have to go home and come back the night the drunks were there. And I turned to leave. And I'll never be any nearer death than I was when I turned to leave that night. At long last I'd come, and it was the wrong night. Now here is the reason I'm here. This next minute is the essence, in my opinion, of our fellowship. Somebody in the middle of that room had been watching me. And when I turned to leave, he came running over to the door and he called to me. And he says, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." Well, he says, "What were you looking for then?" And I said, "If it wouldn't interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety." And everything about that man changed, just like that. It was just like somebody had pressed a button. He lit up like a Christmas tree. And it was obvious to me that he was glad I was there. Now, I was no bargain. I'd just come off of a 4 or 5 weeks blackout. But to him, I was a bargain. So much so that he lit up like a Christmas tree. Some of you know what I'm talking about and why I'm a little emotional about it. Because, you see, my own flesh and blood wouldn't even spit on me. And here's a man that I had never seen before in my life. They was so glad I was there. He lit up. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. And when he did, this is what he said. Why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And he took me in and rocked me to sleep. Now, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Without this, no recoveries. No recoveries. We are allowed to get sober by the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. We maintain sobriety by the practice of the principles. But in my opinion, no man, no alcoholic, man or woman, ever got sober on profundities or principles. I do not believe that there's enough intellectual knowledge on the face of the earth to get one alcoholic sober and keep him sober. We get sober by the spirit of this society. The spirit that made that man come trotting over the door. The spirit that made him light up like a Christmas tree and take me in and rock me to sleep. The spirit that made some of you people get out of bed last night 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and go clear across town to sit with somebody that was in trouble. The spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're allowed to get sober by the spirit. We maintain sobriety by the practice of the principles. And the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous is spelled L-O-V-E, love. Did it ever occur to you how fortunate we are that we love each other? Did it ever occur to you? A wet drunk is not easy to love. It just pretty nearly takes one to love one, doesn't it? We're the most fortunate people in the world that we love each other. And without any thought of criticism or judgment, because I do not even hope that the non-alcoholic world will ever understand us, because I don't understand myself. You see, I was a periodic, as Mrs. C. told you this morning, for the last dozen years that I drank. And I could look at my record between drunks for a dozen years when I was physically as sober as I am now. I could look at my record, and up until the very last drunk, I could always convince myself that I had learned my lesson. This time it's going to be different. This time it's going to be different, right up until the last drunk. And of course it was worse, just like it had always been. But I didn't learn that easy. So I don't expect the non-alcoholic world to understand our antics. And so I'm not speaking in judgment. But if a non-alcoholic sees us, one of us, in the gutter, he gives us a wide berth. He very likely thinks that we deserve to be there. If we had any backbone or willpower, we wouldn't be there. I expect some of them even think we enjoy it there. You know? So they give us a wide berth. But when you and I see one of us in the gutter, we know that he's not there because he wants to be there. He's there because he has to be there. He hates that gutter more than anything in the world. Because, you see, he's been there before. He hates it. But he's there because he don't know how not to be there. And we know that. And so we can go over and pick him up and carry him home with us. And love him back to health. This is AA. This is the thing that makes this work. When, insofar as I am able to perceive, nothing much else does. Now, I'm not opposed to any other attempt at getting us sober, keeping us sober. I'm not opposed to them. I don't know enough about them to be opposed to them. Because I came here 33 years and 6 months and a few days ago. And I've never had to go anyplace else. And I've never had a drink or sedating or tranquilizing pill since. And furthermore, I've never had one conscious desire for a drink since I got here. The reason I'm here is because that guy came over to the door. Had he not come to the door, I might never have gotten back. I might have gone out there and never come back at all. But you see, he cared. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. We're a very fortunate bunch that we love each other. There are a few little things that I want to talk about before I get started. There are a couple of conditions in this little deal of ours that come before the first step of the 12 steps. One of them is the first line of the second paragraph of chapter 3. And it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. Now that's way back in chapter 3. Our program of recovery is in chapter 5. So why would this be back in chapter 3 and the first part of chapter 3 at that? I think it's because if we be alcoholic, we're caught in a trap we cannot spring. We have to have help. And we can't get help until we recognize the need for it. God himself can't help us until we let him. So, says the book, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. To fully concede to our innermost self is admitting the fact, but it's also accepting the fact. And that's, according to the book, the first step in recovery. The second thing comes in chapter 5. But it also comes before step 1. And it says, if you've decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Any length means that sobriety comes first. And I'm one who believes that unless and or until sobriety comes first, we cannot have it. And unless it remains first, we cannot keep it. Because otherwise we will not do the things necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. We won't do it. I don't believe that any alcoholic, man or woman, and as far as I'm concerned, there are only two kinds of alcoholics, male and female. I don't think we have any grade A, B, and C alcoholics at all. I don't believe it's possible to be a little bit alcoholic. It's a great deal like pregnancy. He either is, he ain't. And I don't believe that any alcoholic can walk up to step one and take it cold. I don't believe it can be done. Because step one is a twofold admission of defeat. Step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, physical, that our lives had become unmanageable, mental. We've lost the battle twice over with step one. Now nobody's going to take that if he can keep from it. If it had been possible for me to survive without it, I'd not be here. Twofold admission of defeat. In the very first step, we are not people who were born to lose. We're people who were born to win. And we almost did. We almost did. I call us the almost people. Almost was I president of the United States. I'm old enough. But I got just a little bit alcoholic. And that's all, brother. We're not people that run around surrendering on every other street corner. And here, the very first step is a twofold admission of defeat. And the second step is worse than the first. It says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, I submit to you that there's an implication here. Sane people don't need to be restored to sanity. So, number one, we've lost the battle twice over. Number two, we're nuts. Now that's pretty fast going for an alk, isn't it? But it don't get any better. Number three is worse than both of them. Number three says we got to get out of the driver's seat. We got to turn over the keys. Now, as serious as this is, this tickles the hell out of me. When I was a drinking man, nobody could get my keys. I wouldn't have given my keys to God. The only way they could get my keys was to wait till I passed out. I could come out of a pub at 3 o'clock in the morning with my wife or yours. She'd say to me, honey, give me the key. I'll ride.
I'd say, whose car?
Whose car are you going to drive? This is my car. If you're going with me, get in. You might be there at daylight. You ain't gone no place, but you still got the keys. Number three says you got to give up the keys. And not only that, you got to get out of the driver's seat. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. We got to get out of the driver's seat. Now, this is not the ordinary performance of an alcoholic. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. As we understood him, thank God, has no reference to understanding the infinite. Understanding God is not a requirement for sobriety. Thank God. The as we understood him refers to the necessity of individual experience. My God. Your God. The necessity of individual experience. I hunted your God for 30 years before I got here. From 13 to 43. I went through all the great religions and philosophy of the world trying to find out how come I didn't get saved at 13 when I tried so hard to get saved. 30 years I looked, and I got to be very, very learned in the religions and philosophies of the world. I wasn't known as a drunken deacon for 10 years for nothing, I'll tell you that. But nothing happened. Now I want to tell you what did happen and what has come about in my life since it did. My last drunk started the Friday before Christmas, 1945. My boss man called me in, and he says, Charlie, I was Charlie in business. He says, you've had a lot of trouble this year. He didn't mention booze, but he knew that I knew what he was talking about when he said trouble. And he was a non-alcoholic. So he thought he had it figured out. He says, I think I know what the problem is. I think it's because of the pressure you're under. Now, says he, I'm going to take a little pressure off of you. And maybe next year you won't have so much pressure and you won't have so much trouble. And instead of shooting me, as he had every right to do, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. The Friday before Christmas, 1945, to take the pressure off of me. Now, if you don't think he took the pressure off me, you're nuts. There's one thing that's worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune, and that's good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. Now that was not par for the course for me, because I was periodic for the last dozen years that I drank. And periodics don't taper off. Way out of Taver on. And it usually took me from 30 to 60 days to get off my feet after the first slug, after a dry spell. I always made it, but it took a little time. But the last trip out, I got drunk on the way home. And I remember nothing from that day until after the middle of January 1946. If Mrs. Z were telling this story on me, she's made a lot of misstatements this morning that you heard. I've done my best with her for a long time. But if she were telling this story right now, she would tell you that through that 4 or 5 weeks period, I emptied 7 quarts of whiskey every 3 days. Now, I didn't say that. She says it. I can't contradict her because I wasn't there. So I don't know. And personally, I don't believe that 7 quarts of whiskey is too much for 3 days. If you only do it 3 days. But if you're going to do it for 4 or 5 weeks straight, it's either too much or just enough. And in my case, it was just enough. Because I came to sometime after the middle of January 1946. With the clearest head I've ever known in my lifetime. Which is impossible, really, if you look at it. Because I never ate when I drank. And I had nothing in me but whiskey. But I came to with the clearest head I've ever known. And I saw me for the first time in my life with nothing between me and me. Every excuse was burned out. The wants were gone. I didn't have any. I knew that morning that I'd lost the battle of life. I did not know why, because I knew nothing of the disease of alcoholism. But I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. And it was the first time in 43 years of life that I had ever admitted defeat. I knew why Mrs. C was divorcing me. I might quickly say without cause. I'd given her 20 of the best years of my life already. And yes, she was divorced me. And I knew why. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. And I knew why our kids wouldn't even come home when I was around if they could help it. And I knew why the boss man had sent word to the house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window that he had picked out for that purpose don't open. I totally and completely accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone, and that I was not entitled to have it back. Now I'm going to say that again, because this is what my life has been built on for 33 years. I totally and completely accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone, and that I was not entitled to have it back. I also accepted death, because I'd come so close to it the next to the last time that I knew this time, which was worse, I was going to die, and it was all right. But I didn't want to die with the record. I tell you how close I came the next to the last time out. In my withdrawal period, I went to the kitchen after a glass of buttermilk, which was my tonic. Mrs. C. and Richard were sitting in the living room, and they heard me let out a beller, and they heard me hit the floor. And they came running out thinking I would be in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my want. But I wasn't. I had done used up all my alcoholic convulsions, and I was just lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody you ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. They tell me I was a peculiar fella. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. And they got all exercised and called the oxygen squad at Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital. Now, again, I have a peculiar sense of humor. I think this is one of the funniest things that I ever heard tell of in my life. Because my wife and my kids had been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. And they came to the kitchen, found me dead, and called the oxygen squad. That blows my mind. And they sent a squad down there, and I have reason to believe they brought me around. I remember what happened after I came to. There's a doctor with him, and he told me, he says he to me. He says, to all intents and purposes, you were dead. He says, we have had a hell of a time bringing you to. He says, nobody will ever bring you to again under these conditions. We agreed on that. And then he gave me the finest piece of counsel I will ever hear. He looked me right in the eye and he said, if I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. Now I want to pass that on. If I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. But I did it again. And the last time was worse than the next to the last time, so I knew I was going to die, and it was all right. But I didn't want to die with a record. Now, quickly, in my despondency that morning, I remembered that Mrs. C. had found Jack Alexander's article in the Post. In 1941, March 41, she had read it and she had thought that it might be of some value to me, and she left it on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now, opened at the right page, hoping that when I came in, if I came in, I would read it. And I did. I remembered that morning that I had read that article. I only remembered two things about it because I was drunk when I read it. I remembered that drunks helped drunks and didn't drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I will find AA. And immediately the curtain dropped. My little period of sanity was over. And I was sickened to death, drunk and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from that second of commitment until right now, I have never had a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. Such is the great significance of this thing called surrender. Surrender. Surrender's victory for the alcoholic. This is one we win by giving up the fight. Would to God it was possible for one of us to tell another what it means to surrender. Would to God. I would rather tell one audience what it means to surrender than to be president of the universe. But it cannot be done. There is no way that anybody will ever know without the experience. I believe that this surrender bit is the most misunderstood experience in human life. Surrender in our so-called civilization is a dirty word. It was not even in my vocabulary. I never surrendered one time in 43 years of life. And so I can say to you this evening, without fear of successful contradiction, that the greatest single event that has ever happened in my life happened sometime between the Friday before Christmas, 1945, and the middle of January, 1946. And the only thing I did to bring it about, I drank the whiskey. And sometime in that period, everything between me and me was burned out. And I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, surrendered. I didn't want anything for me. Not even sobriety. Because my life was over. All I wanted at all was that I must not drink until I died. So that I could use that time to rub out as much of the record as I could before I kicked off. I never got to the place all through my drinking career that I didn't love my wife and my kids. I always loved them. And many of you people have lived with people like me. And you have known that we didn't love you. Mrs. C told me 500 times, I bet you. Chuck, if you loved us, you wouldn't do these things. And how could I tell them that it was because I loved them that I did? You can't sell that bill of goods. But it's the truth. I told you I was a periodic for the last dozen years. And I could look at my record between drunks with physically sober eyes. And I knew what I was doing to my wife and my kids. And I wanted to take them in my arms and say, listen, I love you. I'll never do this again. So help me God. But I couldn't. I'm going to do it again because I didn't know how not to do it again. And so I'd lie in my bed, and it was that far from hers for that whole last period. And I'd wait till I knew that she was asleep because of her breathing. And then I'd cry me up a river. I'd cry that pillow full of tears because I loved him. And I knew that I was going to crucify him again. So all I wanted to do was to rub out as much of that record as I could before I kicked off. And I must come to you to find out how not to drink today, so I could use this time to rub out. And so, I told you about my first meeting. I knew that the people that were there were drunks, because they hadn't been sober long enough to get rid of the markings. They had headlights here, like I did. They had bags under bags. The wiring was exposed. And I knew they were drunks. And I knew they weren't drunk. And I saw their eyes. And it was comfortable there. And so I was back in a meeting every night for 6 months. Every night I was back there. For two reasons. Number one, it was comfortable there. And number two, I didn't have any place else to go. And that helped. So after 6 months of meeting every night, I discovered something beautiful. I hadn't had a drink or pill for 6 months. What a deal. Not a drink or a pill for 6 months. And I was so tickled about it, I got busy trying to give this thing back to the drunks. And another 6 months went by. And I made another discovery that was fantastic. I discovered that I had a family. And they were living like kittens. And this was a beautiful discovery. I'll tell you a little highlight on that. I had me a gal in Beverly. She's a little bitty thing. Probably 25 years my senior. And she's very wealthy. She lived up in the big numbers. I lived between Wilshire and Olympic, down on the flatlands where the poor people live. But she lived up in the hills. She was very wealthy. And she was an alky. And she went to meeting with me all the time. I'd call her, I'd say, "Louise, how about a meeting tonight?" She'd say, "Come and get me." And away we'd go. But sometime between the first 6 months and the first year, she called the house thinking to get me. And she got Mr. Z on the line. And she said, "Who in the hell are you?" Mrs. Z says, "I'm Chuck's wife." "Didn't know he had a wife." Mrs. Z says, "Well, he doesn't either." And I didn't. And here I discover I got a wife and kids. And they're living like kittens. And what a discovery this is. And another 6 months went by. And I discovered I was still down the office trying to clean up my desk. And business was good. Business was plumb good. And that was a good discovery. Now a year goes by. And I discovered that my own state of being was better than anything I'd ever dreamed of. It was just good to be alive. Just good to be alive. And that ain't a bad discovery. Now 6 years have gone by. And I discovered I was never alone anymore. I, who had walked alone for a lifetime, I'd never been a part of in my life. I wanted so much to be a part of, but I always walked alone. And here I discovered I was never alone anymore. I had a God of my very own. And wherever I am, he is. Now, this is the great discovery. When we make this discovery, the search is over. And life begins. It's a fantastic thing. I think that we're the most fortunate segment of mankind. We alcoholics. Because our formula for sobriety is the finest formula that was ever conceived in the mind of man through the grace of God to obtain and maintain sobriety. But the same formula is also the formula for the good life and for self-discovery. The very same formula. Provided we do the things that the book tells us to do, or suggests that we do, for sobriety only. I think that most of our troubles are caused because of conditions on our sobriety. Conditions. For instance, related disorders. Now, I got to the program with about the finest crop of related disorders that you can get together. I had no home, no job, no health, no sanity, and no money. Now, I don't think you can collect a much better bunch than that. It's quite a nice crop of related disorders. I never spent 5 seconds on any one of them. Not 5 seconds. And all of them disappeared along with the obsession to drink, and I didn't even know when they left. I discovered that they were gone. And so that's the reason I think that our program is nothing in the world but uncovering, discovering, and discarding. That's our program. Uncovering, discovering, and discarding. The first 9 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will surrender anybody that takes them for sobriety only. That's what they're there for, to squeeze us out of ourselves. To get rid of the I want, I don't want, I don't like, I yay, 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 yay. That's the purpose of the first 9 steps. To surrender us. And if we get here not surrendered and do these things honestly, we will be surrendered when we get through 9. And then we can look deeper than us and find us, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. It's a fantastic thing. We uncover and discover the thing we've been looking for all our lives. And I could see tonight what we belong to, it would blind us all. This is the most fantastic thing that anybody ever got to teach in. Now, mind you, the things that I'm saying tonight are things that have happened to me. They're in many, many books that I've read also, but that isn't the reason I talk about them. It's because it happened to me. This is my life. I take credit for the first 43 years of it. I was the master of ceremonies and the star of the show for 43 years. And at the end of 43 years, I was a failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. And that's all the departments I had. If I had any more departments, I'd have failed in them too. But that was all. I take the credit for that. I take absolutely no credit for what's happened to me in the last 33 years and 6 months. None. Because all I have done for 33 years and 6 months is to make one 12-step call. That's all I've done. When I could talk after my little experience, I called my wife in. I knew she was divorced from him and it was all right. And I called her in and I says, "Honey, it's no longer of any consequence to me whether or not I live under this roof. It is of absolutely no importance to me at all. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as the two of us live at one. If I can ever add anything to your life, let me give it to you." And we closed the book. And it's never been reopened. I went to the office before I'd ever been to you people. Because I knew where the office was. And I had to find you by the roundabout way because of my keen alcoholic mind. So I went down to the office, knowing the guy was going to throw me through the window, and knowing that he could, because I was not in robust health. We call it down here puny. I was a little puny. He saw my old car in the parking lot, knew I was on the premises, and knew I wasn't going to stay. So I busted into the office like a bull in a china closet. And here I am. I couldn't have defended myself with a shotgun. Because I didn't have the shakes. I had to leap. And there he was. And I said, "Vic, leave me alone. I don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that I didn't do. And as soon as I get even with you, I'll get the hell out of here on my own power. You'll never owe me a penny as long as you live. But for God's sake, leave me alone. I've got to get even with you." And he stopped in his tracks. And he said, "What the hell's happened to you, Charlie?" And I says, "Don't know." And I didn't. But he knew something had happened. If Mrs. C were talking to you now, she'd tell you that she knew the first time I talked with her that something had happened. She didn't know what, and neither did he. But he didn't throw me through the window. And months, maybe even 2 or 3 years after that happened, I'd be talking to people in business. Maybe sitting at lunch talking over a business thing, and they'd stop in the middle of a sentence. And they'd say to me, "What the hell's happened to you, Charlie? I've been knowing you for 25 years, and I don't know you. What's happened?" And I'd say, "I don't know." And I didn't. But after the 6 years, as I told you, I discovered I was never alone anymore. I had a God of my very own. Now, insofar as I'm able to perceive, and I'll get through with this in a hurry, if I can, I'd like to start now. I've done overstayed my time because and half a dozen of you or more have asked me to end up with the Lord with the prodigal son story, but I can't do it now because I've run out of time. But anyway, I'd like to start right now because this is where it starts. I am of the opinion, totally convinced, that There's only one problem in life that includes all problems. And only one answer in life that includes all answers. And the problem is duality, and the answer is unity. Duality is the only problem that we have. Duality is the best definition of the human ego you'll ever hear. It's the feeling of conscious separation from. The feeling of conscious separation from. Duality is the thing that causes all the trouble. The human ego is the father and mother of all obsessions of the mind. I want, I don't want, like, I don't like. And it's divinely impossible to satisfy the human ego. For instance, I sit up there on my hill looking out the window, and there's a channel between the coastline and Catalina Island. It's roughly 30 miles across there. And I look at that channel, and I say to me, if that entire channel was bourbon whiskey, it wouldn't be enough to satisfy my obsession to drink. Now, mind you, that 30 miles is just the top of it. It's deep, too. And that'd make a lot of toddies, wouldn't it? But it wouldn't be enough to satisfy my obsession to drink, because it cannot be satisfied. In my last many years of drinking, from the first slug that I took after a dry spell until I was flat on my back drinking the clock around, was just a question of time. And the only time I quit was when I couldn't even lift my head off the pillow. Mrs. C would have to lift up my head and put a little liquid in my mouth to keep me from swallowing my tongue. It's impossible to satisfy my obsession to drink. It's also impossible to satisfy an obsession for money. It can't be done, because it's all relative. All relative. To the guy that hasn't got two coppers rubbed together, $5 is a fortune. The guy that's got $5, he's broke. I had a client out there for many years that had gone from one head of lettuce to $35 million. And he used to say to me in his last years, he'd say, Charlie, how can I be like you? And I'd say, Eddie, you can't. And he'd say, why? And I'd say, Eddie, who needs God when he's got $35 million? You can buy anything you want, including women. And you do. So, Eddie, you go ahead and make yourself $150 million, and you will if you live. And then you come to me and say, Charlie, how can I be like you? And I'll tell you, and you can do it. But not until. You've got to find out, and you would, by the time you get $150 million, that it can't do for you what you have to have done right here. And then you can do the things that allow you to find this way. And he'd say, well, let's talk to me about it anyway. We'd drive all over the state of Arizona talking about things we've been talking about here tonight. But Eddie didn't get his $150. He got so many things in his head it exploded, and we had to bury him. But it's impossible to satisfy an obsession for money. Power. We all lived through Watergate, and everybody in this United States was damaged by Watergate. Nobody won. There were no winners. It's impossible to satisfy an obsession for power. Now let's get real down to earth. Let's say, women. Or men. It's impossible to satisfy an obsession for women. Cannot be done. Let us say just for fun, that I was the greatest Lothario of all times. And every chick that I ever took out after, I caught. But one. Now that would be an amazing army by this time, wouldn't it? Because I've lived a long time. Would that conquest satisfy me? No, this one kills me. The one I can't get kills me. So, if you can't beat him, join him. That's where your surrender comes in. Get rid of the necessity for these things. And it's done by surrender. And for closing, these few remarks. Who else has fought like this in life? Well, many of you do. Personally, I think the carpenter man did. Because he said, you know, at one time, he said, I and my father are one. A little later on, he said, I'm the father, and he and me and I and you. And a little later, he said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. I think that's pretty close. And I think that's what we're talking about. Uncovering and discovering the thing we've been looking for all our lives. There was a chap I liked very much. He and I were childhood friends. He lived in 1666. His name was Brother Lawrence. And I love him. He's a great guy. I'm going to quote a couple of Catholics, and I know that I'm down here in non-Catholic territory. But I can quote them because I'm not a Catholic. You can't say I came down here to late Catholicism on you, because I ain't one. But anyway, Brother Lawrence was. And he was a dishwasher. He was pot and pan washer in a monastery just out of Paris in 1666. And he said that everybody would be yelling for a different thing at the same time. He said he didn't pay any attention to him. He just went ahead talking to God. Washing pots and pans. Said he didn't know where his prayers of office started and stopped and his prayers began. And he became quite a counselor. He was a great man. And in talking to one of his troubled folks, he says to the guy, he is within you. Look not for him elsewhere. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. Then there was another guy. He was a Dominican priest. He lived in Germany. About the same time, around the same time, Brother Lawrence. And he said this. He said, you have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum. Can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small. Now, says he, all you got to do is to get empty of self. And automatically, you're full of God. That's what we're talking about. To get rid of the only roadblock there is between me and you and me and God, which is the human ego. And there it is. There it is. We discover the thing we've been looking for all our lives. Now, I've lived with you people for 33 years. And in living with you, I have become totally convinced from the top of my longest hair to my toenails that the first two words of the Lord's Prayer mean what to say. Our Father God. You know, when they said to the carpenter man, Master, teach us to pray. He said, after this manner pray ye, our Father. His Father, your Father, and mine. And I believe this with everything that's in me. Now, if it be true, you can let your imagination go crazy. And you can't even get close to the truth of being itself. You can't even get close to it. This is more fabulous than angel dust. It beats LSD all to pieces. It's even better than bourbon whiskey, and that's tops. That's why there's a thing in the same book, that other book. There's a God before us, who can be against us? And the answer is nobody and nothing. So, again, in closing, I'm closed now for 2 or 3 hours. I'm awful close to on time, you know that? But I haven't quit yet. You see, I tried so hard from 13 to 43 to get what I thought I was born without. I tried so hard. And I wasn't a fast book artist and I wasn't a confidence man. I worked hard to get. And I ended up at 43. A total failure, without 2 coppers to rub together. And I quit trying to get anything then, and started trying to rub out a record. And you can't rub out a record thinking I want or don't want. You have to do something for somebody without a price tag on it, if you're going to rub out a record. And I just got busy doing that. And all the things that I beat my brains out to get and ended up without are now mine in spades. It's impossible, but there they are. Now nobody will ever know that St. Francis knew what he was talking about when he says, for it's in giving that we receive, until he's tried it and proven it in his own life. And it's proven in mine. Now, I tried to go someplace all my life. You know, you're supposed to go someplace. You got to be this, have that, and be known as before you can really live. You got to get out there and go. Well, I got out there and went. And I went right into the perdition. That's where I went. And I quit going any place. And I've been all over the world. Yeah, since I quit going any place. I've been all over the world. I had the great opportunity to meet people like you all over this globe, perdition. And you know something? They're all just like you. Just like you. Don't go someplace to find a better one. You got them right here in Atlanta. So, again and again and again, my life is the proof that the program works if we work it. And it's very necessary, I think, that we get rid of all the conditions and do the thing for the purpose it was written. You see, our program was worked out by drunks, proven by drunks, written down by drunks for drunks. And if we do the thing for our alcoholism, which is our number one problem, we will find it includes all the rest of the problems too. They all go by the boards. And we can walk in the conscious awareness of the living presence of God. And it's fabulous. It beats anything that anybody ever dreamed of. And it's so simple, I feel stupid talking about it. And I'm so grateful I can't see. I'm so grateful I can't see. I actually thank God for hell. Because I didn't spend 5 seconds in hell that wasn't necessary. And the thing that got me here, I would go through again. And my good wife says that she would go through it again. If it took that to find the life that we've had. Don't be afraid of it. This is it. God bless you. Thank you very much.